Hello, and welcome to A History of Japan. Season 6, Episode 19, The Genpei War, Part 1, An Ill-Fated Uprising. The Genpei War was a 5-year conflict between two powerful clans that occupied the political development of Japan from 1180 to 1185. The name Genpei is derived from combining the kanji characters of the two primary belligerents, Taira and Minamoto, and pronouncing them together as a compound. While the character for Taira can also be pronounced Heikei, and the character for Minamoto can also be pronounced Genji, I will be sticking generally with the names Taira and Minamoto because that is what I've done so far, and it would just be confusing to change that now. This episode is the first of a 4-part series covering the Genpei War. I wanted to capture the epic sweep of history, the dramatic reversals of fortune, and the interclan conflicts that erupted amidst the great clash of the Taira and Minamoto. So, I did. Fair warning, I will be sticking to the major battles that determined the course of the war, and largely ignoring the smaller skirmishes which were largely indecisive or irrelevant to the overall development of the conflict. With all that in mind, let's discuss how this samurai civil war began. While Taira Kiyomori dominated the court in both the military and political spheres, there were a few problems with this approach to wielding absolute power. The Ritsuryo system of government, the bureaucratic institutions imported from China like ministers of the left and right, various councils below them, etc., worked quite well in the capital, but its performance in the provinces was, to vastly understate the matter, insufficient. Once they achieved political domination in the capital, the Issei Taira clan took control of provincial appointments and ensured that their allies, as well as their own members, received governor and assistant governor postings in the wealthiest provinces. To assist them in maximizing their tax revenue, the provincial governors would generally appoint agents who would live in the provinces and oversee tax tribute collection. Prior to the Taira takeover, these agents would gain the allegiance of local provincial authorities and work alongside them, ensuring that everyone got a piece of the action, so to speak. However, the Taira began making recommendations for these agents to be appointed from among their own network of vassals, allies, and cronies. The Taira muscle that accompanied the agents tended to err on the side of intimidation rather than partnership, and the common people of the provinces, as well as the local samurai, resented the coercive presence. In spite of any external shortcomings, however, the Issei Taira clan was, by all appearances, absolutely supreme. Taira Kiyomori continued to lead the clan, and indeed the nation. The year before the outbreak of the civil war in 1180, however, he had suffered a personal tragedy when his eldest son and heir, Taira Shigemori, died of an illness. His death was a tragedy for the entire clan, in many ways, as he had a reputation for fair-mindedness and clear-eyed sobriety. Had he outlived his father, it's entirely possible that the Genpei War, and indeed all of Japanese history, would have taken a very different course. Kiyomori's second son became his heir apparent, Taira Munemori. The sources are not kind to Munemori, and often portray him as a bumbling buffoon who was in no way capable of anything that would ever be asked of him in any context. The fairness of this characterization is for you to decide, but certainly the Taira clan at the time felt the gravity of losing the great Shigemori, beside whom very few other samurai or kuge could hope to measure up. Munemori's younger brothers Tomomori and Shigehira would also play active roles in the upcoming civil war in various capacities, and we will explore them in greater detail as we continue. The histories tend to frequently lapse into referring to one side of the Genpei War as the Taira clan, and the other side as the Minamoto clan, and while I may occasionally slip into such characterization, please remember that this refers only to the leading samurai of either side. Just having the surname Taira or Minamoto did not necessarily indicate close ties with either the Kawachi Minamoto or the Issei Taira. It is better to think of both groups as networks rather than clans in and of themselves. With that in mind, let's meet the relevant Minamoto who would soon become embroiled in this feud. One of the only people with the name Minamoto who even still lived in the capital after the Heiji Rebellion was Minamoto Yorimasa, who was now around 76 years old. While his lineage was of the Seiwa Genji, his family hailed from Settsu province in Kansai and were only distantly related to the Koachi Genji. In fact, Yorimasa had sided with the Issei Taira during the Heiji Rebellion, and he had been a personal friend of Taira Kiyomori himself. Yorimasa was also on very good terms with the temples, partly because he showed respect for their portable shrines when he was called in to quell their riots. It seems unlikely that Yorimasa had been planning to launch a rebellion, given his advanced age and relative friendliness with the Taira leaders. The forced retirement of Emperor Takakura and the elevation of Kiyomori's grandson to the chrysanthemum throne was a bold maneuver, but it did not sit right with many samurai who might otherwise support the Taira. Yorimasa retired from his military service in 1179, but he still maintained relationships with retainers and vassals. The third son of retired Emperor Go Shirakawa, Prince Mochihito, had long nurtured the expectation that he would one day become the emperor. He had been passed over, however, when his younger brother became Emperor Takakura, and then passed over a second time when Takakura Tenno retired and Emperor Antoku took the throne. The frustration of both Yorimasa and Mochihito was likely galvanized by popular disapproval of Kiyomori's kingmaking, and Yorimasa urged the prince to call upon the Koachi Minamoto of Kanto to support his bid for the throne. Mochihito agreed and penned a letter which was dispatched in secret to Minamoto Yoritomo in the east. We will discuss that scion of the Koachi Minamoto in greater detail shortly, but the son of Yoshitomo was still gathering troops when Taira Kiyomori discovered the plot and ordered the arrest of Prince Mochihito and subsequent banishment to Tosa Province on Shikoku. Kiyomori's ignorance of Yorimasa's involvement was a boon to the conspirators. The chancellor had given the arrest order to one of Yorimasa's sons, who warned his father. Knowing that their allies in the east were still potentially months away from mobilizing, and certain that Kiyomori would eventually discover his role in this plot, Yorimasa turned to the only other nearby ally he could count on, the monks of Miidera Temple. They held him in great esteem and were also generally opposed to Taira Kiyomori's dictatorship, though this was less about principle and more because he continually opposed them in battle. Nevertheless, the enemy of his enemy was Yorimasa's friend. He fled from the capital as quickly as he could with Prince Mochihito in tow. Miidera is to the northeast of Heian-kyo, and the journey was probably not very long. When they arrived, the monks of Miidera were certainly sympathetic to Prince Mochihito's plight and the larger cause of toppling Kiyomori's regime, but the timing was not exactly providential. Amid the shifting winds of the feuding temples, Miidera was in a weak position. None of the other three major temples were allied with them at the moment, and it seemed unlikely that any reinforcements would arrive before the Taira-allied samurai inevitably besieged Miidera itself. Nevertheless, the monks constructed palisades and other defensive structures around their temple complex. When attempting to ignite a civil war, the early stages are often critical for long-term success. While Yorimasa was correct in thinking that the Minamoto could find allies among the Sohei thanks to their mutual hatred of Taira domination, he had made a bad first move and acted quickly to rectify it. He wanted to lead his retainers on a night attack of the Rokuhara Palace, the headquarters of the Taira clan in the capital, but Prince Mochihito strenuously objected to this. Here we see some shades of the Hogen Rebellion, which also featured one side reluctant to launch a night ambush. As you may recall, that was the losing side. While he appreciated the generosity of the Miidera Ordinance, Yorimasa did not like their meager forces' chances trying to defend the temple, which was bordered on one side by Lake Biwa and could easily be encircled. Luckily, word came that Kofukuji had pledged to support Prince Mochihito's claim, so Yorimasa and his warband struck south for the Nara Basin with the prince. The need for speed was paramount. If the Tyra strike force got word of their maneuver, they could easily intercept them and cut them off from their allies to the south. They arrived at Uji, just southwest of the capital, and took up shelter in the nearby Byodo-in, the famous Phoenix Hall, which was converted from a long-dead nobleman's retirement villa. Best estimates indicate that Yorimasa probably had as many as 50 armed samurai in his company at the moment, and their numbers were bolstered by Sohei monks from Midera who had escorted them. They crossed the Uji Bridge to take up positions on the opposite bank by the temple. This bridge, like many others in Japan at the time, was a great arched bridge, and they tore planks from the side nearest to them to prevent an easy crossing by their foes. Minamoto Yorimasa's plan was to defend their position on the southern bank and hold out long enough for reinforcements to arrive in the form of Sohei marching north from Kofukuji Temple in Nara. The tale of the Heike tells of many thousands of Taira-allied samurai who marched upon Yorimasa's position, but the number is likely much less. Still, the accounts in Heike Monogatari are compelling for the details they reveal about samurai combat in the Heian period. Pitched battles between armies generally included some ceremonial components. First, whistling arrows would be launched to frighten away any fell spirits that might interfere with the impending clash. The head of one of these arrows was an acorn or piece of carved wood with holes drilled into it, which produced a piercing, high-pitched sound when launched through the air. A warrior of high noble pedigree would then ride out from one battle line and shout their lineage, being sure to include their most famous ancestors. A samurai from the opposing side would do the same, thereby accepting the challenge, and then the two would ride toward each other while they loosed arrows until someone fell from their horse, usually dead. If each expended their arrows and yet lived, they would draw swords and continue the fight. Like their European counterparts, samurai often carried backup weapons like a spiked baseball bat club called a kanabo, short hip swords called koshigatana, and their daggers called tanto. Accounts of the battles of Taira Masakado in 939 and 940 indicate some level of pedigree announcement and ritual single combat, though we're really not certain when this practice actually began. It is often compared to Western European knights challenging one another to single combat, though historian Stephen Turnbull postulates that a better comparison is to the chieftains recorded in the Iliad. The outcome of the duel not only determined who possessed superior ancestors, but also marked the winner as especially brave and could earn them more influence among the lower-ranking samurai. While it is tempting to imagine the archery portion of the duel occurring when the combatants are a great distance from one another, sources seem to indicate that arrows were probably discharged at close range, between 5 and 10 meters, around 16 and 33 feet. From this distance, weak points in an opponent's armor could be spotted and targeted, but because this went both ways, samurai in single combat needed to carefully balance their distance and the relative skill of their opponent. In the account of the Battle of Uji, the plank removal trap seems to have worked as the Minamoto and their warrior monk allies intended. According to the tale of the Heike, the samurai in the vanguard charging on foot across the bridge were unable to relay the warning toward the rear of their forces quickly enough, and the rearmost soldiers continued pushing those ahead of them, who pushed those ahead of them, and so on, until the front ranks on the bridge were plummeting to their deaths in the shallow river far below. The warrior monks on the opposite side of the bridge loosed vicious volleys of arrows into the ranks of the Taira forces, who returned fire as best as they were able. An account of one Naginata-wielding monk in particular, Gochin Tajima, claims that he knocked the arrows from mid-air with his halberd, but historian Stephen Turnbull claims that it is more likely that the flashing of his blade distracted the archers and caused them to miss. Several Sohei warriors closed the gap, balancing on the bare support beams and charging fearlessly into the enemy ranks. Fierce hand-to-hand battles ensued, which usually ended with the bold Sohei dying, but only after they had slain 8 or 10 of the enemy. Ashikaga Tadatsuna, a Taira-allied warrior named in the tale of the Heike, is credited with suggesting a new course of action as the day wore on and Minamoto Yorimasa's forces continued holding the southern bank of the Uji River. Recounting another battle from long ago, he proclaimed that those among them who were mounted should ford the river with their horses, trusting the animal to see them safely through the currents. The Uji River was not especially deep overall, but it was very wide, and it was difficult to judge depth beforehand. Tadatsuna charged across the river first, calling out his pedigree as he went, which included Fujiwara Hide Sato, the slayer of the rebel Taira Masakado. He crossed successfully, and his warband followed along with many other Taira-allied horsemen once they saw that the river was relatively safe to ford. Now being attacked from two sides, the Minamoto and their allied Sohei fell back to the structures of the Byodo-in, with the Taira hot on their heels. Things looked pretty grim at this point. Minamoto Yorimasa had been wounded by an arrow in his elbow, and he harbored no illusions that he would survive this encounter. His sons Kanetsuna and Nakatsuna fought ferociously to give their father time to commit suicide rather than be executed like a common criminal. As the Taira-allied samurai slaughtered their way to the hall, Yorimasa asked one of his retainers to cut off his head. The man refused, but agreed to perform the decapitation after Yorimasa had dispatched himself first. Minamoto Yorimasa sat facing west toward the alleged location of the Buddha Amida's paradise, and chanted 10 times the Nembutsu mantra, Namu Amida Butsu, which was a common practice of those at death's door. Then, being a talented poet in his own right, he composed this verse. Like a fossil tree, from which we gather no flowers, sad has been my life, no fruit to produce. Then he took his tanto dagger and cut across his abdomen and bled out. His retainer completed the beheading, then wrapped his master's head in a sack filled with rocks and tossed it into the river so that the Taira could not take it to the capital as a trophy. Minamoto Yorimasa's lasting contributions to Japanese culture were the composition of a death poem and the ritual of seppuku. While he was obviously not the first to kill himself in battle when capture was imminent, the Tale of the Heike claims that he was the first to establish the ritual basis for samurai self-destruction. While other sources will claim the first proper seppuku was performed by Minamoto Tametomo in 1170, Minamoto Yorimasa is still generally credited with establishing the custom. Part of what motivated Yorimasa to have his warriors die in a glorious last stand against the Taira army was the hope that it would buy time for Prince Mochihito to reach Nara. As he neared the gate of a shrine just south of Byodo-in, however, he was struck and killed by a Taira arrow. By the time the Sohei of Kofukuji arrived, the battle was long over, and their allies were utterly crushed, so they sensibly returned to their temple. This event would be remembered as the First Battle of Uji, which is exactly as ominous as it sounds. The samurai chancellor Kiyomori was enraged that the Sohei of Midera would openly support his enemies, and sent his army to that temple with punishment in mind. The samurai did as the chancellor ordered. They burned the temple complex to the ground and systematically slaughtered anyone they found within. Many brave warrior monks staged a valiant but doomed defense of Midera, while others slipped away to safety. To the other three major temples, Kiyomori sent gifts, which were really outright bribes, to encourage them to stay out of such political affairs in the future. While Taira Kiyomori was pleased that the traitor Yorimasa and the pretender Mochihito were dead, he did not believe that the threat had passed. If a loser like Mochihito could fall victim to delusions of grandeur, then who's to say that other lower members of the imperial family might similarly attempt to undermine the samurai chancellor? For their safety, of course, this is all just about safety, you guys, Kiyomori arranged for the government to be relocated to a town in Settsu province called Fukuhara, which would now be called Fukuhara-kyo. Settsu had been a Taira clan stronghold for many years, and Kiyomori himself enjoyed vast influence over its provincial government, as well as the local samurai clans. The emperor and his family were sure to be very well protected there, both from the thugs of the temples and potential invasion by the Minamoto in the east. The Tale of the Heike judges the move to Fukuhara-kyo as just another instance of Kiyomori's impertinent tyranny. In June, all of Kiyomori's efforts were focused on securing members of the imperial family and setting up the new seat of government in Fukuhara-kyo, and soon he led a procession of the entire government from Heian to the new capital. In July, he decided it was time to settle an old score. Kiyomori issued a warrant for the arrest and execution of Yoritomo, now 33, and sent the order to Taira Kanetaka, the vice governor of Izu Province. Before we delve too far into the events of July 1180, we need to explore the life of Yoritomo after he was spared the executioner's blade and sent in exile to Izu Province in 1160, just after his father led the failed Heiji Rebellion. The Izu Peninsula was a popular destination for political exiles due to its extreme remoteness. Yoritomo was first placed in the care of a local samurai strongman named Ito Sukechika. However, Sukechika lived in the capital most of the time and did little to govern Yoritomo's personal affairs on his estate. Thus, the young Minamoto lived a relatively free existence and even seduced the daughter of Ito Sukechika, a young woman named Yaihime. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When her father discovered this affair, he flew into a rage fueled by terror. Remaining in the good graces of the Issei Taira clan was the cornerstone of Sukechika's career, and all the good fortune that they had blessed him with could be rescinded in a flash if they believed he was harboring rebellious tendencies. Allowing Minamoto Yoritomo, the heir of their enemy Yoshimoto, to become his son-in-law would put him and his family in real danger of retribution from the Taira leaders. To solve this problem, Sukechika drowned his grandson in a river and made arrangements for Yoritomo's assassination. Yoritomo was forewarned, however, and made his escape to another powerful local samurai, Hojo Tokimasa. The Hojo had been local elites in Izu Province for a long time before this, but we don't know how long because it seems that they had not yet developed any connections in the capital, so records of their earlier family history are murky at best. Yoritomo was wise to seek their protection because Tokimasa did not care about staying on the Taira clan's good side, and may have even seen an opportunity in the arrival of this new ward. In short order, he offered one of his daughters in marriage to Yoritomo, and the Minamoto scion happily accepted. Hojo Masako was her name, and it is a name you would do well to remember for next season, he said ominously. You may be wondering why Minamoto Yoritomo was the subject of so much attention both from Taira partisans and ambitious samurai strongmen. The reason is influence. While his father, Minamoto Yoshitomo, was 20 years in the grave at this point, Yoritomo stood to inherit not only those holdings that remained in Kawachi Province, but the vassal network which his father had managed to create. You may recall from Episode 9 that during the Gosannen War in Tohoku, Minamoto Yoshiie specifically refuted the claim of the Kiyohara clan that his father had sworn vassalage to them, because that would mean that Yoshiie had inherited that vassal status. Similarly, hereditary vassals to the Minamoto were numerous, and many had suffered depredations of Taira flunkies who had relocated to Kanto and often encroached upon their shoans. In July of 1180, Yoritomo and his allies sprang into action once they were informed that the vice-governor of Izu Province, Taira Kanetaka, had received the warrant for Yoritomo's arrest and execution. Relying heavily on the support of the Sasaki clan of Sagami Province, who were distantly descended from the Kawachi Minamoto, Yoritomo planned a surprise attack on Yagami, the provincial capital of Izu Province where Kanetaka was recruiting troops for his campaign. Yoritomo's strike force was small, probably 50 samurai, which partly explains the choice to take the initiative in a surprise attack. However, Yoritomo himself was not present at Yagami for this surprise attack. While his father had been a mighty warrior of great renown, Yoritomo held to a much more deeply religious worldview, and he stayed behind at the camp while his warriors went to fight, praying intently for their victory. The attack on Yagami was indeed successful, and Kanetaka was killed. Afterward, the victorious samurai brought Yoritomo the heads of those they had slain. Viewing the heads of slain enemies and doling special rewards for famous kills was part of samurai combat ritual. Events swiftly turned against Yoritomo's good fortune, however. A former hereditary vassal of the Minamoto named Oba Kagechika returned from serving in the capital to Sagami Province, which is to the northeast of Izu. hardly a Minamoto dead ender, Kagechika had sworn allegiance to the Taira and took part in the battle at Uji Bridge. He was joined by Ito Tsukechika, the man who had murdered Yoritomo's son, and now seemed hell-bent on destroying the upstart Minamoto by any means necessary. 6 days after the ambush at Yagami, Yoritomo's forces were attacked by Oba Kagechika's warband in a narrow valley near a place called Ishibashiyama in southern Sagami province. Yoritomo's confederation had grown since their victory at Yagami to around 300 warriors. As they engaged with Kagechika's samurai, largely on foot due to the rough terrain, Ito Tsukechika's warband arrived from Izu, and Yoritomo's troops were now caught between two forces who likely outnumbered them in total by about 10 to 1. The Battle of Ishibashiyama went extremely poorly for the Minamoto allied samurai. Reinforcements from the Miura clan were cut off in the north by unexpected flooding of the Sakawa River. The Minamoto partisans fled in a chaotic rout, many seeking shelter in the high rocky mountains around the valley, which were not easily scaled on horseback. Minamoto Yoritomo himself raced quickly away from the fighting, and the story goes that he hid within a hollow tree with one of his retainers until his pursuers passed them by. This is probably a romantic retcon, but I have to concede that it is possible the incident is true. The opening battles of the Genpei War resulted in two major wins for the Taira clan, and only one minor win for the Minamoto. Contemporary spectators at the time could probably be forgiven for thinking that this war, if it was even a large enough conflict to warrant such a label, was practically over. However, Minamoto Yoritomo was still alive and, hollow tree hiding places notwithstanding, possessed a few large long-term advantages over those who sought his head. Next time, we will discuss Yoritomo's next moves after his humiliating defeat and see how he pulled off what historian Stephen Turnbull describes as the most remarkable reversal of fortune in Japanese history. Until then, thank you for listening. If you would like access to exclusive bonus episodes, as well as ad-free versions of the regular episodes, please consider supporting this podcast at patreon.com/ahistoryofjapan. It remains an unfortunate fact of life that money can't buy happiness. It can, however, buy you a new shirt, magnet, sticker, mug, or journal featuring exclusive designs related to this podcast. By visiting ahistoryofjapan.threadless.com and buying some of the items featured there, you get yourself something beautiful and help support this podcast at the same time. Again, that's ahistoryofjapan.threadless.com. Visit the store today.